pause for a few moments of silent prayer that will afford you the opportunity to shift gears into strict academic discipline and the use of rebound if necessary. Shall we pray? Father, we're extremely grateful to you for the continuing mercies that you shower upon us on a daily basis. We thank you for our freedom. We thank you for our rights. It is our prayer that as we utilize them this morning, that we will have a better idea of how important these rights are. And we lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. This morning, Pastor Griffin will be an iconoclast. An iconoclast is someone who tears down those things considered to be sacred idols. The Constitution of the United States is revered by right-thinking Americans as the fountainhead of its freedoms. The document has stubbornly held fast against the relentless attempts to conjure from its articles and amendments permission to arrogate powers to the federal government that were not granted to it by the states. Nevertheless, over the past century, informed citizens have been able to perceive that its preamble's pledge to, quote, secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity has been gradually redefined to mean secure the blessings of government to ourselves and our posterity. During the debates that preceded ratification, there were forward thinkers who warned about the inherent jeopardy of granting too much power to a central government. They perceived that future office holders among the three branches of government would not necessarily possess the same honor and integrity as those who were first elected. To guard against the interlopers on liberty, there were those who argued against the ratification of the Constitution. In fact, the convention at which the Constitution was drafted met at the behest of the respective states for the purpose of strengthening the Articles of Confederation. Instead, the delegates, in secrecy, cobbled together an entirely new government. And this is a brief analysis of the events that precipitated the need for revision, the resultant drafting of the Constitution, the intrigue that surrounded its creation, the debates that followed among the 13 states, and the compromise to attach a Bill of Rights that led to its adoption. Now, there is a background that is necessary here. We must have a brief understanding of the Articles of Confederation. After the Declaration of Independence was signed by representatives of the 13 states, the next order of business was to form a government. In November of 1777, the Articles of Confederation were completed and sent to the 13 states for ratification. By the way, that means approval. The citizens of the new nation were determined to withhold as much power from a central government as possible to avoid falling under the oppressive hand of a monarch such as George III or a legislature such as the British Parliament. Article 2 of the document proclaims, each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. In other words, the states retain their sovereignty and the majority of power, and they maintain their independence. The freedoms left to the states included the option to set import duties and restrictions, and these stipulations varied among the states, so much so that to avoid the red tape, British and European traders stopped their business with the United States. Now, this resulted in a 25% drop in foreign trade, which included a 20% decline in farm income. Now, combined with this was Spain's decision to close the port of New Orleans, They did that to all American commerce on the Mississippi River. This forced farmers out of business since there were no roads over the Appalachian Mountains by which Western farmers could transport their grain to Eastern markets. Unable to sell their goods, foreclosure shut down hundreds of farms as livestock, land, and equipment were lost. And those whose inventory did not cover the debt were taken to debtors' prisons, leaving distraught wives and terrified children helpless and homeless. Similar circumstances occurred in Massachusetts, where taxes were raised to cover lost government revenue. When property was confiscated as a result, farmers in the western part of the state joined Daniel Shays in an insurrection. Shays, by the way, was a captain in the Continental Army who fought with distinction in the battles of Bunker Hill, Ticonderoga, Saratoga, and Stony Point. This was known as Shays' Rebellion. The irate farmers attacked the U.S. arsenal at Springfield, Massachusetts, but were repulsed by militia. Nevertheless, the effort solidified farmers across the state, and the next election removed the governor and three-fourths of the legislature from office. Fearful of a national uprising, Congress proposed a revision of the Articles of Confederation that would strengthen the national government's powers, and George Washington promoted the idea, as did Patrick Henry, that is, until the latter was made aware of a proposed treaty submitted to Congress by Secretary of Foreign Affairs John Jay. Jay had been in a year-long negotiation with Spanish envoy Don Diego de Gardoqui, who suggested a treaty in which the United States would forbear navigation of the Mississippi River for 30 years in exchange for Spain opening its key ports as European gateways for American trade. Jay had asked Congress to change his instruction to allow him to give up American navigation rights on the Mississippi, and the Congress agreed to it. Southern states were immediately outraged. The northern states were giddy, and Patrick Henry was irate. The five southern states would lose commerce from the western frontier, while the slack would be taken up by Atlantic ports, primarily in the north. Henry's fury was stoked by Jay's violation of Congress's specific instruction that the treaty must ensure free navigation of the Mississippi. Article 2 in the Articles of Confederation ensured states' rights, and to further ensure that foreign powers could not encroach upon them, Article 6 addressed the issue of treaties. It's quoted here, "No state, without the consent of the United States in Congress assembled, shall enter into any conference, agreement, alliance, or treaty with any king, prince, or state." Had the Articles not strictly forbidden entering into treaties without a two-third approval by Congress, then the interest of the northern states would have easily trumped those in the South. You can see that in the very beginning, there was conflict economically driven between the northern states and the southern states. The northern states were more involved in mercantilism, while the southern, of course, were involved in farming and crops. And so this kind of internecine conflict was evident at the very beginning of our republic and became the catalyst for the war between the states 75 years later. There is certainly an element involving the slaves of the South that fomented the war between the states. That fomentation was primarily stoked by the abolitionists of Kansas. And therefore, rather than allowing the South to gradually allow the black population to be amalgamated into the white population, That was trumped by the abolitionists, and as a result, the black population was dumped into a strange society without the ability to amalgamate. The war between the states, of course, was essential in resolving that issue, but we still suffer today from the lack of amalgamation at the beginning. The real issue that stoked the war between the states had to do with states' rights. It had to do with the assumed independence of the individual states to run their own affairs, and it was none of the federal government's business. We're going to see today that although the South was standing for states' rights, the Constitution that they ratified had robbed them of their sovereignty. The Articles of Confederation was shown to be too weak to manage such a large swath of the North American continent, which was in the incipient stages as a nation. Shays' Rebellion and the Gay-Gardoki Treaty exposed not only this weakness, but the potential tug of war that would only intensify if some stronger but mollifying system was not put into place. This led Alexander Hamilton to call for a convention in Philadelphia, quote, to render the Constitution of the federal government adequate to the exigencies of the Union. That federal constitution were the Articles of Confederation. Now, on February 21st of 1787, the Confederation Congress recommended that the states send delegates to a convention, quote, for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. Virginia Governor Edmund Randolph wrote a letter to Henry encouraging him to attend the convention, which Henry declined without offering a reason. George Washington and James Madison made personal pleas to Henry to reconsider to no avail. In fact, Madison advised Washington, quote, Mr. Henry, who has been hitherto the champion of the federal cause, has become a cold advocate, and in the event of an actual sacrifice of the Mississippi by Congress, will unquestionably go over to the opposite side. In fact, for Henry, the die was already cast. He rationalized that if the impotent Articles of Confederation had almost stripped Virginia of her natural rights to ship goods to market, an even stronger version would surely succeed at some future date. Henry did not want to grant too much power to a centralized government. That will be the key to his arguments that we'll note this morning. That he was correct in his assessment is evidenced by a letter to Henry by James Monroe regarding negotiations surrounding the Jay-Gardoki Treaty. Now, let me point out something to you as we move along. The title of this is The Fight for Our Rights, Federalists versus Anti-Federalists. Let me give you some names of the Federalists. George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton. There were others, including James Madison. James Madison is one of the fellows that will pop up in our study. There were those who were anti-federalist, and they included Patrick Henry and Edmund Randolph, the present governor of Virginia in our location of the text here. There was James Monroe, famous for the Monroe Doctrine, and there were others, as we'll note as we go along. Now, to put it in the context of today's vernacular, the Federalists were progressives, which sought centralized power, where the anti-federalists were traditionalists, which sought the diminishment of power away from the central government down to the states. So this argument that is going to ensue on the ratification of the Constitution will be about the tug of war between how much power can be granted a central government and how much can be retained by the states. And we're going to see that the progressives won at the very beginning. That he was correct in his assessment is evidenced by a letter to Henry by James Monroe regarding negotiations surrounding the Jay-Gardoki Treaty. On August 12, 1786, Monroe wrote a long letter to Governor Patrick Henry. At this point, Henry was governor of Virginia, reporting that, quote, committees are held in this town, meaning Washington, of Eastern men, that means New England, New York, Pennsylvania, and others of this state, namely Virginia, upon the subject of a dismemberment of the states east of the Hudson River from the Union and the erection of them into a separate government. So now you have the guys involved in mercantilism in New England feeling their oats and wanting to separate from the rest of the Union so that they can therefore have it their own way. Their separatist scheme, Monroe reported, is talked of in Massachusetts familiarly and is supposed to have originated there. Bay State Congressman Nathaniel Gorham, Rufus King, and Theodore Sedgwick sought to encourage a Spanish treaty that closed the Mississippi for 25 to 30 years. Their plan, Monroe told Henry, was not only a step toward the creation of a separate Northern Confederacy, it was also connected with other objects, and perhaps with that upon which the convention will sit at Annapolis. By closing the Mississippi, Monroe warned Henry, they sought to break up the settlements on the western waters, meaning the Mississippi, and prevent any in the future. This would make it the interest of the western people to separate from the Confederacy so as to throw the weight of the government and population in this quarter. James Monroe also told Governor Henry that in conversations at which I have been present, New England congressmen spoke of a dismemberment so as to include Pennsylvania. Sometimes, Monroe said, they hoped even to include Delaware and Maryland in a northern confederation of all states southward to the Potomac River. Now, when the convention to upgrade the Articles was convened in 1787, Henry's defection was joined by others, including New York Governor George Clinton, then Virginia Governor Edmund Randolph, Richard Henry Lee, George Mason, James Monroe, and William Grayson. This group was stuck with the title Anti-Federalists. Those who emerged from the convention recommending ratification of a new government under a new constitution included George Washington, James Madison, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, and I'm sad to report Light Horse Harry Lee, the father of Robert E. Lee. Ratification depended on the Federalist winning the debate. But the objections raised by the Anti-Federalist and verbalized by the surgically precise orations of Patrick Henry proved to be prophetic as we look back retrospectively over the 123 years since the Constitution's ratification. Third section of our study is George Washington's intrigue. George Washington has been given the nom de guerre Sword of the Revolution and the title Father of His Country. He may also be regarded as the ramrod of the Constitution. Congress called a convention in Philadelphia to consider strengthening the Articles of Confederation. But Washington micromanaged the delegates to abandon the congressional mandate and instead create an entirely new government. The general's military reputation had rightly won him the honor and respect of most, if not all, of those attending the convention, and he immediately began capitalizing on his credentials to influence their thinking toward a new constitution. On Thursday, May 17 of 1787, although South Carolina and New York delegates had arrived, the convention still lacked a quorum. Over the next week, enough delegates arrived from Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Delaware to produce a quorum of seven states. Washington made a point of collaring most of them at various dinners in his honor or theirs, and drumming into their minds that he favored a new constitution, creating a strong central government with legislative, executive, and judiciary departments concentrated. Washington considered his lobbying so successful that once the convention was gaveled to order, he was certain the requirement to revise the Articles of Confederation would be abandoned in favor of a new national government. Robert Morris, probably the wealthiest man in America and a close friend of Washington's, called the convention to order and nominated Washington to preside as president. By procedural rules, this election forbade the general from entering into discussions or commenting during the debates. This, however, had no impact on his ability to manage the delegates or influence the eventual outcome of their decision. At least 36 delegates seated before him had served under him in the Revolutionary War and knew all too well how to discern Washington's pleasure or displeasure from his all but imperceptible nods, frowns, scowls, or smiles. He knew them, and they knew him, some intimately. Four of them, Pennsylvania Speaker of the Assembly Thomas Mifflin, Virginia Governor Edmund Randolph, Maryland Congressman James McHenry, and New York Attorney Alexander Hamilton, had served as close personal aides on his staff during the Revolutionary War. 13 had been officers in the Continental Army. 13 others, officers in the militia. 7 delegates had served with Washington in the Continental Congress of 1774 or 75, or both. Prior to the convention, Washington sent all the state governors and political leaders his conception of a new national government. What became known as the Virginia Plan was the first order of business as soon as Washington was elected president of the convention. Since Edmund Randolph was Virginia's governor, he reluctantly agreed to read the proposal to the delegates, reluctantly because he had gone to Philadelphia seeking only minor revisions to the Articles of Confederation. Instead, he put in motion a process that would ignore the current government and establish an entirely new one. The eventual result was a bloodless coup d'etat, what Unger characterized as America's Second Revolution, which became the title of his 2007 book on the subject. The Virginia Plan presented numerous resolutions, primary of which was the elimination of the Confederation Congress and the creation of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary branches of a new national government. This plan outlined a system by which laws passed by its Congress would be supreme. They would override state laws and grant use of the military to enforce them. The rationale cited the incompatibility of the various states' conflicting systems of laws and their reluctance to abide by those imposed by the Confederation Congress. The delegates collectively rejected this plan. It robbed the states of their sovereignty and was out of order, since the Congress's instruction to them was to revise the Articles of Confederation. To consider the Virginia Plan would be to consider overthrowing the legally constituted government by adopting an entirely new system. Virginia's Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, an attorney, challenged the legality of Randolph having the authority to propose anything beyond what the Congress had directed. Here's his quote. "The act of Congress recommending the convention did not authorize a discussion of a system founded on different principles from the federal Constitution," meaning the Articles of Confederation. The Virginia Plan, he argued, violated the mandate of Congress to revise the Articles of Confederation. To violate that mandate would represent a usurpation of authority not granted by Congress or by the Articles of Confederation. Both Northern and Southern delegates were collectively repulsed by the use of the word supreme. The Northern merchants visualized customs agents directing import-export duties away from their states into the national treasury, while Southern planters feared the presence of federal troops on their lands, replacing those of the recently defeated British Army. No one was excited about voting on the proposal, and to avoid the necessity, a motion was made and passed to convert the convention into a committee of the whole House. That term needs to be defined so you understand what's going on. Let's note from the Random House Dictionary, this phrase, committee of the whole House, refers to the entire membership of a legislative body sitting in a deliberative rather than a legislative capacity for informal debate and parliamentary consideration of matters awaiting legislative action. In other words, rather than sitting in a legislative environment where votes can be cast and therefore counted and ideas passed into law, they converted the entire House into a committee. And in the committee, they can freely discuss issues. They can even vote and later retract their votes. But none of it can do anything but then ultimately issue to the legislative branch, which is themselves, what their recommendations are. And then they can vote up or down. There's another definition that I pulled off Wikipedia. I'm nervous about that site, but the definition's good, so I went with it. In the version of the Committee of the Whole that existed in the British House of Commons, the original use of this committee was to debate bills privately and prevent a recorded vote from being taken. So rather than sit in an environment where they can therefore have their votes cast and therefore known back in their respective states, they converted the entire body into a committee. And here is where the arguments could freely begin without any fear of retribution from their constituents. Well, this convenient procedure allowed discussion and debate with privilege to change one's opinion or vote, and no vote on the Virginia plan while in committee would be final. So they could vote there on various issues, but it would not be final until it went to the legislative body, thus dissolving the committee. The resultant debate became not only unfettered, but also vociferous, as the delegations from the smaller states argued that larger states would dominate the Union. As the debate raged, delegates grew increasingly mean-spirited, with some Northerners even mocking the accents of delegates from the Deep South, to which Southerners countered by pretending they could not understand Boston's delegates and asked them to repeat themselves. Reminds me of my dad. When he moved up here, people would say that they enjoyed his Southern accent. And he said, "I'm not the one with the accent." I love that. One of the critical arguments had to do with the size of the majority that could confirm a treaty. See, they had this Jay Gardoki thing that had really upset the Southern states, and it was on the verge of being passed, and because there had to be a two-thirds approval, they fell about two or three votes short in the Congress of passing this thing. And it would shut down the Mississippi River for 30 years. Well, that would have moved into about 1825, approximately. I think it was our man Thomas Jefferson who bought the whole area in around the year 1800 or so. Well, Southern delegates had clear memory of how close the Jay Gardoki Treaty was defeated, but only because the Articles of Confederation required a two-thirds majority for confirmation. They insisted on and won that requirement from the Northern states. So please note that Washington has ramrodded this thing into a committee, and now they're actually debating illegally how to structure this new government. And one of the issues that comes up has to do with treaties. And so they all say, we don't want a repeat of Jay Gardoki. We do not want this thing written as it presently stands, to where you can have a treaty with just a majority vote. So they lobbied for two-thirds and they got it. Now keep this in mind. We will get to the point where we will read from the Constitution that any treaty the United States enters into is the law of the land and will supersede any state law that is in contradistinction to it. And that's why it is so nerve-wracking to me for presidents to get involved in signing treaties, because whatever's in those treaties become the law of the land by per our Constitution. You should be very wary of treaties, especially this crowd we've got going now. Each day was wrought with controversy, dispute, and deadlock, which ultimately caused Washington to lose all patience. He began to lobby delegates outside the meeting hall in the city tavern. These guys were quick to go have a cool one. And at private homes, demanding they reach compromise. Every state has some objection. That which is most pressing to one is obnoxious to the other, and vice versa. If then the union of the whole is a desirable object, so that's an assumption by, this is a quote by Washington, that this is an if clause, you will note. I would say that it is a third class condition. His is first. If then the union of the whole is a desirable object, the parts which compose it must yield a little, mind you, in order to accomplish it. Yield a little winds up meaning loss of sovereignty before it's over. On September 12, Pennsylvania's Governor Morris recited the completed manuscript of what was to become the Constitution of the United States of America. He not only wrote the preamble, but was also the one who stylized the entire manuscript, for the wording of the document is primarily that chosen by Morris. The wording of the preamble not only recalls that of the Declaration of Independence, but it also begins with the seed of collectivism which Patrick Henry would later assail. Here is the preamble to the Constitution, which you all were forced to memorize at some point in school. We probably didn't, but you were asked to. We the people of the United States, and we the people ripped it with Henry, by the way. His contention was, how do you have the chutzpah to call it we the people? It should read we the states. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now, Morris continued to recite the entire manuscript, which contains seven articles. The first three articles define the shape and powers of the national legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. These gave Congress powers to raise taxes and levy duties, borrow money, regulate foreign and interstate commerce, maintain a standing army and navy, and declare war. The president was to be the commander-in-chief of the military, have diplomatic powers, and make treaties. Article 4 forced the states to recognize each other's laws and the procedure for adding new states to the Union. Article 5 gave the process for amending the Constitution, stipulating that two-thirds of both houses of Congress may propose an amendment, but it would not be ratified without the consent of three-fourths of the states, thank God. Article 6 stipulated that the Constitution, U.S. laws, and treaties. Article 6, now listen to me. Article 6 stipulated that the Constitution, U.S. laws, and treaties rank highest as, quote, supreme law of the land, with local laws lowest and of no consequence for the rest of the nation. Article 7 mandated that 2/3 of the states, or 9 of the 13 in this case, must ratify the Constitution for adoption to take effect. George Washington was the first to sign. However, Virginia Governor Randolph, who introduced the Virginia Plan to the convention, refused to sign, calling the document, quote, a fetus of monarchy, saying it was impossible to put his name to the instrument. Virginia's George Mason criticized, quote, the dangerous power and structure of the government. He predicted the Constitution would lead either to monarchy or a tyrannical aristocracy, and proclaimed, as the Constitution now stands, I can neither support it or give it my vote in Virginia, and I cannot sign here what I cannot support there. That brings us to taking sides. I want to see if I want to quit here. Virginia was the key state in the ratification process. And in Virginia, there were stalwarts of independence who were openly opposed to the concentration of power in a centralized government that left the states and their citizens with no guarantees of their rights, that their rights would not be infringed. Patrick Henry, George Mason, Richard Henry Lee, and Edmund Randolph were opposed to ratification, and without Virginia's consent, even if ratified, the Union would be split and the Constitution ineffective. Washington's dream depended on winning the favor of the voice of independence, Patrick Henry. Upon his return to Mount Vernon, Washington wrote to Henry, in the first months of my return, first moments I should read, I take the liberty of sending you a copy of the Constitution which the Federal Convention has submitted to the people of these states. I wish the Constitution had been more perfect, but I sincerely believe it is the best that could be obtained at this time. And as a constitutional door is open for amendment hereafter, the adoption of it under present circumstances of the Union is, in my opinion, desirable. The political concerns of this country are suspended by a thread. If nothing had been agreed upon, anarchy would soon have ensued, the seeds being ripely sown in every soil. Henry was not in the mood to receive such correspondence from a man whom he admired most among his fellow patriots. His disgust was so adamantly directed toward the Constitution that he could only respond to Washington in muted tones. Here's his response. I have to lament that I cannot bring my mind in accord with the proposed Constitution. The concern I feel on this account is really greater than I am able to express. Perhaps mature reflection may furnish me reasons to change my present sentiments into a conformity with the opinion of those personages of whom I have highest reverence. Well, be that as it may, I beg you will be persuaded of the unalterable regard and attachment with which I ever shall be, dear sir, your obliged and very humble servant. Patrick Henry thought the highest of George Washington. He considered him the ultimate patriot. The concept of the sword of the revolution, as he was tabbed, was something he totally agreed with. There's no one who can't revere George Washington. But in this particular incident, we discover that as a politician, George Washington was a progressive, whereas a general on the battlefield, he won our independence. Now, all of these things are debatable. I'm just giving you the facts here. At the last page of this will give you books you can read, and you can educate yourself about this. I've netted it to me all week to net this thing down to where I thought I could jam it into 2 hours. There's lots more. Henry's concerns were so numerous that he felt it inappropriate to enumerate them in a letter to Washington. He would save his objections for the upcoming debates. Certain phrases in the Constitution hinted at inevitable tyranny, such as the threat of unlimited and unbounded power over the states granted in the final paragraph of Article 1, Section 8. To make all laws, now this is after you can get 40 proclamations, the Constitution is at your fingertips here. And you can go to Article 1, Section 8, and there's an entire list of the powers that are going to be delegated here to the Congress. And then once all of those things are mentioned, then we have this concluding remark. This refers to Congress. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. When Henry read that, those three words, necessary and proper, completely turned him off the entire notion. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Make any law. Henry was further troubled that there were no term limits for the president, for members of Congress, or the judiciary. All could serve indefinitely and possibly collude to create a tyranny, collude with foreign governments to sell territorial rights, as Congress had almost done with Spain regarding the Jay Gardoqui Treaty. He didn't like the government having the power to maintain a standing army, impose taxes without consent of the states, to negative state laws and to enforce federal laws with troops, which has been done in this country in the 20th century. His primary concern was that the states lost their sovereignty and the individual rights to freedom of speech, religion, press, trial by jury, redress of grievances, and assembly were not protected. Virginia's Declaration of Rights guaranteed all of these things, but they now could be overridden by the superior federal government. Make all laws. Many of the grievances expressed in the Declaration of Independence were now again a concern to Henry. The states had abused this power under the Confederation. Now it was given to the superior Congress. Representatives, this is a quote from Article 1, Section 2, Paragraph 3, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states. Henry had long opposed any permanent national government tax, yet the Constitution granted this power in its very first article. Henry's fears have presently been proved prophetic. In February 1913, the 16th Amendment was ratified that reads, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived." Today, the power to tax has allowed Congress to wittingly run up a national debt of $14,465,350,000,000, and that was last night. There is a thing called U.S. debt clock you can log on to, and you can watch the numbers go by so fast you can't read them, and I timed how long it took for our debt to go up $1 million. It takes 1 minute and 1 second for the debt to increase by $1 million. 1 minute and 1 second. $1 million. The gross national product by compared to the national debt is 97.9%. We're soon going to have more debt than the GNP. Power of the central government to tax without approval by the states. Henry's objection, by the way, the passage of the 16th Amendment in 1913 was coordinated with this whole idea of what we have today of a central bank. Somebody had something on their mind, didn't they? And I'll bet they were from the Northeast. I'm just guessing. Henry's objections, along with those of James Mason and Richard Henry Lee, had significant impact outside Virginia. The Freeman's Journal of Philadelphia cautioned about Congress's power to lay and collect taxes, the date of publication I've noted in parentheses. Philadelphia's Independent Gazetteer wrote that the Constitution would create, quote, a permanent aristocracy. And the Massachusetts Sentinel, that's correctly spelled, by the way, the Massachusetts Sentinel warned, you are forging chains for yourself and your children. Your liberties are at stake. Anti-Federalists were swaying public opinion against ratification. But in the state legislatures, the Federalists had majorities and were able to call the conventions. Notice that progressives ruled at the very beginning. By February of 1788, Connecticut, Delaware, Georgia, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania had ratified. I put them in alphabetical order, but the order of ratification started with Delaware, followed 5 days later by Pennsylvania, a piece of information that will become handy a little later. Pennsylvania was second, not first. The vote in Pennsylvania was literally stolen by the strong-arm tactics of none other than Benjamin Franklin. I think he's on one of our pieces of money. He ignored all principles of self-government by leading the delegation out of the Constitutional Convention. You know where Independence Hall is in Philadelphia. You've seen the pictures of it. I think it's on the money somewhere. And that was the state capital, in essence, under the Articles of Confederation for the state of Pennsylvania, and it was in Philadelphia. So they're in the same building. So once this thing was voted on, then out they come. And he was a representative there for the state of Pennsylvania. Franklin ignored all principles of self-government by leading the delegation out of the Constitutional Convention and marching into the Pennsylvania Assembly Hall in the same building. Interrupting the assembly's proceedings, he all but promised that Philadelphia would be the new federal capital if Pennsylvania was first to ratify the Constitution. He urged state legislators to call a state ratification convention immediately without debate. Like other major property owners in the city, Franklin stood to reap enormous profits if the new government established the capital in Philadelphia. Angry backcountry anti-federalists, however, refused to appear in the assembly and left it 2 members short of a quorum. Speaker Thomas Mifflin, the wealthy Philadelphia merchant, ordered a sergeant-at-arms and a clerk to find at least 2 absent members and order them to the hall. A mob of Federalists followed the 2 to the boarding house where many anti-Federalists lodged and physically dragged 2 assemblymen back to their seats in the State House, where despite their shouts of protests, sentries physically restrained them while Federalists voted to hold the ratification convention on November the 20th. Well, they got the Capitol, but they didn't ratify first. Delaware beat them to it. Patrick Henry was appalled at Pennsylvania was tricked into ratifying the Constitution. Governor George Clinton of New York was prepared to secede rather than allow his state to cede its sovereignty to a national government. Now, when we come back from tea and crumpets, we'll enter into the debate section. And paragraph 5, we're going to note the fight for the Bill of Rights. And that's where we have our debates perking up. And that is going to take us over to number 6. Paragraph 6 will be addressed as an epilogue. So those 2 things are going to net all of this out for us. And we'll do that at approximately 10 till the hour.